I want to call your attention now to the ninth chapter of the book of Job. Job chapter 9, and the first verse says, "Then Job answered and said," and that's all we're going to read here at this point. We'll read the remainder of it as we proceed through this chapter in this hour. Here is Job's answer to Bildad. In way of introduction here to this chapter, actually the next two chapters, because both chapters 9 and 10 are the answer of Job to Bildad, we always pity Job when we come to the book of Job. If we're honest, we recognize that he was tempted more than most any of us have been or ever expect to be. We know, of course, there's even a greater comfort in knowing that our Lord Jesus Christ was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Job was tempted and there was some sin. Not the kind of sin that the three friends assumed and accused Job of. But we see some strengths and weaknesses in Job. Before he was put to the test, there was nothing that surfaced in his life that was sinful in a notable way. All it takes is for God to turn up the heat a little bit, and impurities in our lives come to the surface like we cannot imagine, like maybe others did not imagine we had. This prolonged misery and this ongoing sickness in his body, and on top of all of that, these assaults from those that were his friends who came to comfort but end up condemning him has certainly worn Job down by this point. His faith is shaken to its very foundations. God seems far away from Job. Job is sort of in the dark as far as what is going on and why. We've seen that he repeatedly longs for death. He wants God to kill him so that he can escape from these afflictions. He wants just a little bit of relief, even if death is that relief. I think maybe the best summary of these two chapters here is in chapter 10, verse 15, where he says about halfway through, "I am full of confusion." And that summarizes Job not only in this discourse, but in most of his discourses here in this book. Full of confusion. And the thing about Job is that you see so much of yourself in him. And though we have so much more New Testament light and knowledge and revelation, and though we have the advantage of drawing on the book of Job and knowing that God has purposes for the things that happen in our lives that we may not have any clue about, the book of Job assures us that is the case. Yet with all of these advantages, how often are we still, like Job, full of confusion, distressed? And so we can learn some good things from Job and some things to avoid as well. There are some great statements in chapter 9 that we're going to look at here, and we'll have to look at it quickly because it's a long chapter. And then, unfortunately, there are some statements that I don't know how to take in a very positive way. And surely we can nonetheless learn from those. You notice in this chapter that he does not attack Bildad. He does not answer in kind. He keeps the focus of the discussion upon God and God's dealings and God's method with men and God's greatness and power, wisdom. So let's begin here. In a sense, the question of verse 2 sort of sets the stage for all that follows. I know, he says, it is so of a truth, but how should man be just with God? He says, Bildad, I know that much of what you have said is true. The basic focus of Bildad's arguments there in chapter 8 is true, as we saw last time. Especially viewing it from the perspective of God's eternal justice, that the wicked are punished, the righteous are blessed. Why, the scriptures teach that through and through. I know it is so, of a truth. But there is still this remaining question, how should a man be just with God? If it's true that God rewards the righteous, then how does a person become righteous? And I don't mean to read more into this question than Job is asking. We could certainly do something Spurgeonic and see Job asking a question here about justification and address that whole glorious, grand subject. But I think that Job is asking something like this. If it's true that God rewards the righteous, then how can a person be righteous with God? How can anyone even begin to approach God? And the thing that leads Job to ask this question is a sense of his own sin and a sense of the holiness of God, the perfection of God, and the infinite excellence of God and the evil that is in the heart of every man. To ask a question like this surely shows us something of the depth of understanding that Job had, at least of the sinfulness of his own heart and the sinfulness of the heart of every fallen son of Adam. How should man be just with God? Some writers take this as sort of a complaint, that Job is saying God's standards are outrageously high. God has set this goal or this standard at perfection. Well, how can anybody reach such a thing? This is unrealistic. This is unfair. But I don't take it that way. I see it as more of a genuine confession on the part of Job concerning the sinfulness of man and the lack of hope in man for approaching God and being set right with God. Job is humbling himself under the greatness of God, and this is a safe place to be. This is where all of us belong, is humbled before God, acknowledging his greatness, his justice, and our sinfulness and our unworthiness. Perhaps Job here is answering in chapter 8 and verse 3, where Bildad says, doth God pervert judgment, or doth the Almighty pervert justice? He's implying by asking this that this is what Job wants God to do. He wants God to be unjust and to reward him with good, even though Job must have some sin that has brought these calamities upon him. So here's Job's answer. How can any man be just in the sight of God? We're all sinners, Bildad. God is holy, Bildad. What hope is there for any of us? And then he gives something of an answer that begins in verse 3, and the way that I've outlined it here, from verse 3 to verse 13, we see this discourse here on God's great wisdom and power. If he will contend with him, if a man will contend with God, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. Bildad, if we enter into debate with God, we will lose the debate. God will give us 1,000 reasons or 1,000 arguments, and we won't be able to answer one of them. Trying to outsmart God is a losing proposition, because God is wise. Verse 4, he is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Just think a moment about these attributes, these two attributes that are mentioned here, wisdom and power. Some of the most mind-boggling truths about the God of Scripture, that he is wise and that he's powerful. He knows everything, and he makes the best use of his knowledge. And he is able to do all of his will. Who hath hardened himself against him and hath prospered? Opposing God is certain defeat. Bildad, do you think that I'm fighting against God? Do you think I'm so foolish as to fight against God? No one has ever won that encounter. The only response is to submit to him, bow before him, fall on your face before him, and receive from his mighty and wise character what he gives. Seek his good gifts. He begins to tell us here some of the things that God does. Verse 5, he removes the mountains, and they know not, which overturneth them in his anger. Maybe there's reference to the flood here, which rearranged the whole topography of the earth. Which shaketh the earth out of her place, and the pillars thereof tremble. That sounds like an earthquake to me. Which commandeth the sun, and it riseth not, and sealeth up the stars. What's that? Maybe an eclipse? Or maybe a cloudy day or cloudy night in which you cannot see the sun nor the stars? Which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea. He's in control of the seas. He spread out the firmament or the atmosphere. He is the one, verse 9, who made these stars, and some of these are mentioned. Arcturus, which is the Great Bear, Ursa Major. Orion, known as the Hunter, or the Arrogant One. That's another meaning of the name Orion. And Pleiades, which is the seven stars. And if you'll step out tonight, if it's a clear night, you'll be able to see these stars. It fascinates me that we're looking at the same ones that Job looked at. And the chambers of the south, verse 9 concludes, probably referring to the stars in the southern hemisphere, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number. This is one of the several passages. This is the first of several passages here in the book of Job that speaks of the greatness of God in creation. Henry Morris, in his book on the book of Job, has a chapter entitled, The Healing power or the healing effect of creation. And indeed, there is a great emphasis here, and Job seems to find great comfort in knowing that the God whom he serves is the God who created the whole earth. It gives us at least some sense of the vastness and the bigness and the infinity of God and the power, yes, and the wisdom of God to contemplate creation. And we'll see that the Lord himself points to this and goes into great detail in some of the final chapters of the book. In fact, that is as much of an answer as God gives to Job at all. Job, I'm the God who created everything. And Job seems to have found great comfort, great conviction as well, in considering these things. And you read the Psalms, they're full of it. We ought to derive much knowledge and much benefit from considering God's creation. God is the Creator. It helps to make us adore Him and to recognize how small we are and to think that He cares at all for us or takes any thought for us, especially for our good, is a very comforting, encouraging thought. Who would dare to resist this God, the God who has created everything? Who would dare stand face to face, nose to nose with Him, if as it were? No. He's a great friend, but He's a terrible foe. And Job is not about to find fault with God. What can we do? What can finite little creatures like us do before God, except to humble ourselves and to submit to Him and by His enabling grace to obey His commands? That is our duty. And to worship Him, that is our duty. Job understood that. He goes on and says in verse 11 something very interesting here. Lo, he goeth by me, and I see him not. He passeth on also, but I perceive him not. There's some other similar statements in other portions of the book of Job. What Job is saying here is that he knows that God is near. He knows that God is at work. But as for Job himself, he is in the dark about much of what God is doing. He's saying, I don't understand what's going on with me. I don't understand what God is up to. I don't know why God is doing these things. I know that He has a hand in it. He goes by me. He passes on all. He's all around me. I can't see Him. I can't see His plan. I can't figure it out. Job here is simply admitting his ignorance. Beloved, don't be afraid to admit your ignorance. If you don't understand what God is doing in your life, then you're not alone. You've got some good company. You can stand with Job and continue to trust in God and prove the patience, the same grace of patience that Job proved. It's good for us to admit our ignorance, isn't it? It humbles us, makes us realize that we don't have all knowledge, and that God does. Is this not the fight of faith? Is that not what Job is doing here in this whole book of Job, really? He's fighting the fight of faith. The whole point about faith is that it does not operate by sight. Job cannot see. He can't see what God is up to. He can't see the scenes in chapters 1 and 2 that we have seen, that are revealed in Scripture, about the challenge that Satan gives to God concerning Job. And so, because of a lack of seeing these things, Job is forced to walk by faith. to keep trusting God, the God whom he cannot see. There's a sense in which in the glorified state, in the presence of Christ, we will not need the grace of faith. We need it now. We walk by faith now, whom having not seen ye love. In whom, though now you see him not, which I could quote the whole thing correctly, but you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Proverbs 25 says, it is the glory of God to conceal a thing. God conceals things. He hides things. He didn't let Job in on the whole story here, did he? That forced Job to walk by faith, to trust God every step of the way, to depend on God where he could not see. Remember, the Lord Jesus said to the disciples in John 13, as he's washing their feet, what I do, thou knowest. Or he said this to Peter, what I do, thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. And that's one of those statements that we can apply to many contexts of our own life. What the Lord is doing now, we do not know. But we will know hereafter. He will reveal more and more of his purpose in these things as time goes on, and surely he will reveal even more in eternity. And so we have to trust the Lord for the uncertain future. And as far as the present trials go, or whatever trials may cross our paths tomorrow, we have to keep trusting the Lord. Walk by faith. We must hasten on. In verse 12, he says, behold, he taketh away. Who can hinder him? Think of all the things God took away from Job. Took away practically everything, including his health. Could Job keep God from taking these things? Job couldn't stop him. God was in control of the thing. In control of everything. Who will say unto him, what doest thou? No. God was the one who removed these things, took away these things. Job is sort of asking, do you think I can put God on trial and make him give an answer as to why he took all these things away? Bildad, do you think that I have the power to run that kind of a courtroom? Why, if Job could do that, if he could make God give him an answer, then Job would be in the place of God. Job would be over God. It's unthinkable. And for some little creature like we quoted last Sunday to get up and say that God is going to have to give an answer for Hurricane Katrina, he needs to go back and read the book of Job, doesn't he? Who will say unto him, what doest thou? Or in the words of Romans in the New Testament, shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Finally, verse 13 in this section. If God will not withdraw his anger, the proud helpers do stoop under him. Unless God is merciful toward his enemies and merciful toward his fallen creatures, then they will all be crushed under him. And these helpers, that the proud helpers spoken of here, may refer to men as in Psalm 2, the kings of the earth who join ranks together to fight against God. And if God doesn't withdraw his anger, this confederacy of evil will be crushed under him. Here is Job's discourse on God's wisdom and power. It is important, beloved, for us to always remember the wisdom and power of God. It's a vital part of maintaining our perspective in trials that last a long time. That God is wise and God is almighty. And so whatever trials that He has sent to me that seem to go on and on and on, He sends because of His wisdom. Look at creation and be humbled before the great God. Consider how small you are. Matthew Henry said, "Hard thoughts of God are inlets of much mischief. Whatever you do, don't think bad thoughts about God." Now, in verses 14 through 21, Job speaks of his own unworthiness. "How much less shall I answer him?" He says, I can't get God to answer me. I can't call him into judgment. And for that matter, what kind of an answer can I give to him? "How much less shall I answer him and choose out my words to reason with him? Who am I to enter into a debate with God? Whom, though I were righteous, yet would I not answer, but I would make supplication to my judge." He says, even if I were without any sin, and let me just say parenthetically here, he's admitting that he is a sinner. He's not pretending to be a sinlessly perfect man. He says, even if I were without sin, I would still have reason to humbly submit myself to God. Not to proudly give him an answer, but rather to make a supplication, to pray unto him. Better to submit to him and seek his favor than to dispute with him. That's what Job is saying. Think about it. Even if you had no sin, you would still have every reason to humble yourself before God, because we are His creatures. How much more then, as sinful creatures, do we have reason to utterly humble ourselves before Him and make supplication to Him who is our judge? Job talks about his prayers in verse 16. Remember in chapter 8, Bildad implies that Job hadn't been praying. Well, Job addresses that here. He says, "If I had called and he had answered me, yet would I not believe that he had hearkened unto my voice." I do not take this as unbelief on the part of Job, but rather as just a further indication of his absolute humiliation before God. He says, "My prayers are weak, and even if God were to answer my prayers and deliver me from these trials or let me die or whatever, I would not think it was because of my praying. God doesn't need my weak prayers. God doesn't need my defective prayers." That's how great and powerful God is. God doesn't depend on my praying for anything. And I'm tempted to spend the rest of the message talking about prayer. But just remember this. Prayer is the means that God has ordained for us to receive many blessings from Him. But God is not dependent on our prayers. God is not ignorant. He doesn't need us to inform Him of these things. Our prayers are not greater than God. Verse 17, "For He breaketh me with a tempest, and multiplieth my wounds without cause. He will not suffer me to take my breath, but filleth me with bitterness." Now, it is easy to see why the three friends of Job would find fault with a statement like this. Job says, "God is giving me wound upon wound and stripe upon stripe without cause." I can imagine Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar listening to that, and their eyes bug wide open, and man, they start thinking, "We're going to answer him on this one. He's really blown it on this one." Well, Job does not defend himself before God. But he does defend himself before man. He defends himself before these three friends. And he is stating to them that these afflictions that have come clearly from the hand of God in his life are not, as they accuse, as these three friends accusingly say, that these things are not punishments for some sin in the life of Job, that these things are all without a cause in Job. I don't think that Job wants us to imagine that God doesn't have a purpose in it. Surely Job understood something, that God had a cause, but that there was no cause in Job himself. And chapters 1 and 2 bear that out very definitely. Job is not saying that God has no purpose in these trials, but he is defending his integrity before these accusers. It may be that the lines become a little bit blurry here, and that in defending himself before men, he almost crosses the line of defending himself before God. And we ought to always be careful of that. But in the ears of the three friends, Job is self-righteous and saying that he has no sin at all. It's not what he's saying. He's saying that there is no extraordinary sin that has brought about these extraordinary sufferings. Verse 19, if I speak of strength, lo, he is strong. If anybody is strong, it's God. I'm no match for him. And if I speak of judgment, who shall set me a time to plead? The whole thought is ridiculous. If I justify myself, mine own mouth shall condemn me. If I say I am perfect, it shall also prove me perverse. And again here, it seems that Job is walking this tightrope. On the one hand, he dares not say that he is without sin before God. None of us is. But he still maintains that he is this perfect and upright man, at least relatively speaking, as chapters 1 and 2 declare unto us. He says, I want God to justify me. I don't want to justify myself. Beloved, self-justification is worthless. Self-justification is of no value. The only justification that counts is God's justifying of us. Job is not interested in justifying himself. And he says, if I do, I'll only condemn myself. The person who sets out to justify himself only ends up condemning himself. I'll tell you, there is a sermon there. There is a gospel sermon there. The futility of self-justification. He says, verse 21, though I were perfect, yet would I not know my soul. I would despise my life. If I were to profess, I'm perfect, I would just be showing my ignorance of my own inner self and my own true soul. I would despise my life. I would become an enemy to myself to even declare such a thing or even profess such a thing as perfection. Job here lets us know that he is humbled before God. He sees his own unworthiness. It is good for us to keep low thoughts of ourselves before God. And let me issue a warning once again. Beware of the self-esteem, good pride teachings that abound in our culture today. if you keep God in view, and if you are comparing yourself to Him, you'll find no room for pride and for this lofty self-esteem. Rather, you will find every reason for utter humiliation before God. In these next verses, 22 through 24, Job gives an unanswerable argument to these friends. He says, "This is one thing, therefore I said it. He destroyeth the perfect and the wicked." That is one of the most important and insightful statements that Job makes here in this discourse and perhaps in the whole book. This is sort of the fly in the ointment for Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, because this is what they say is not true. But Job says this is the way it is. God does destroy the perfect and the wicked. They were saying God destroys the wicked, but they could never say God destroys the perfect. Job, of course, is speaking in terms of this life and present trials, present circumstances. Yes, they come from God also. These three friends could only see that God sends trials upon the wicked because of their wickedness. They could not see that, as in Job's case, God sent trials upon a righteous man because he was righteous. We must never forget that, never overlook that perspective. The godly do suffer with the wicked on this earth in many things. In other words, the outward circumstances do not always indicate the character of a person. This is the unanswerable argument that Job gives to the three friends, and it's the same argument that we give to the people who preach a prosperity gospel today. A person's outward circumstances do not always indicate their spiritual character. Psalm 73, "The ungodly do indeed oftentimes prosper, and the godly suffer in this world." And that's why that day of judgment that we talked about this morning is a comforting thought to God's people. That's why Paul can say, "Rest with us. Remember, there is a day of reckoning that is coming, a day in which the accounts will all be settled according to divine justice." Job is putting the question, or asking the question that needs to be asked. The question is not, is God just? That's the question that his three friends want to put in his mouth. That's the question they want to impose upon Job. Is God just? Chapter 8, verse 3. Doth God pervert judgment? But the question is, are my trials a certain evidence of some particular sin in me? And in Job's case, his conscience is clear. And he can say, no, it's not evidence of that. Happy is the Christian who can, in the midst of severe trials, say, my conscience is clear. These trials are not an evidence of some particular sin in me. Let's read this again. Verse 22, "This is one thing, therefore I said it. He destroyeth the perfect and the wicked. If the scourge slay suddenly, he will laugh at the trial of the innocent." This is just another way of saying that the godly suffer along with the ungodly many times in this world. There were some occasions in the land of Egypt where God made something of an exception to that rule, where the plagues that came upon the Egyptians did not come upon the Israelites. But most of the time, look at Hurricane Katrina. I've got a report today, I haven't even had time to read it, of churches down in the area there that have been destroyed. There's some pictures in an email I just looked at that show destruction of buildings and so forth. The godly suffer right along with the wicked in many things in this earth. And it's not pointing to some unfairness or some injustice in God. But nor does it point to some secret hidden sin in those churches that were destroyed there in that hurricane, as if they should have been the only buildings left standing when all the others were destroyed around them. What it points to is that the fullness and the finality of divine justice will not come in this life. It will come at the last day. As for now, the perfect are destroyed along with the wicked. If the scourge slay suddenly, he will laugh at the trial of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If not, where and who is he? And what Job is saying here in verse 24 is, look at all of the wicked people who are in positions of authority in the earth. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. They rule, they govern so many times. And he, I take that to be God, covers the faces of the judges thereof. That is, righteous judges and righteous judgment is hidden from view. And there's no justice on the earth. And then Job asks, if God isn't the one who does this, then pray tell me, who is it? Who is doing it? If God isn't the one who allows the wicked to be governors and allows the wicked to be judges in the earth, then who is doing it? If God's not in control of it, then who is? It's a very sound argument. Well, we've still got a ways to go here. In verses 25 through 35, we have the last portion of the chapter, and that is really a lamentation on the part of Job. And after saying some good things about God and showing us a side of Job that is encouraging, we sort of come back down to the other side here. Now, my days are swifter than a post. That is, swifter than a mailman who would run as fast as he could, or maybe ride on a donkey or something to deliver a message. My life is passing away. They flee away. They see no good. The brevity of life. They are passed away as the swift ships, as the eagle that hasteth to the prey. In verses 27 and 28, he talks about some vain attempts to find comfort. If I say, I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my heaviness. Sounds like some of these cults today that say, oh, you know, pain doesn't really exist. You just think you have pain and so forth. If I say, I will forget my complaint, I will leave off my heaviness and comfort myself, what happens? I am afraid of all my sorrows. I know that thou wilt not hold me innocent. He seems to speak directly to God here, saying, just ignore the problems. Just comfort yourself. He says, that doesn't work. He's desperate. These sorrows will not go away that easily. Fear and sorrow will not leave me alone. Thou wilt not hold me innocent. Verse 29, if I be wicked, why then labor I in vain? If I'm the sinner that Bildad says I am, then it's useless for me to contend with God. If I wash myself with snow water and make my hands never so clean, yet shalt thou plunge me in the ditch, and mine own clothes shall abhor me. Self-improvement is not going to help Job any, and it's not going to help you or me any. God sees the real man. God sees us through and through. We cannot hide from Him. Job, again, is showing that at least part of him is just driven